Welcome to the Building Leaders Radio Hour, conversation-based podcast featuring interviews with everyday business leaders. We're here to entertain and empower those within and beyond the construction industry, and we're here to share the stories of those who built their own paths and paved the way for the future. We are your hosts, Neil Wilcove and Mark Cleverly.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Building Leaders Radio Hour. This episode serves as part two of Mark and Neil's chat with Gil May, the founding principal of May Architecture. Part one was posted a few weeks ago, so catch up on that if you haven't already. And before we jump into this episode, we want to thank Flying Form Concrete Structures for being the sponsor for this season of Building Leaders Radio Hour. BLRH wouldn't be possible without them. We hope you enjoy part two.
And how did you and your other directors, your other partners evolve? I'm going to, I mean, evolve in it, it may not be the right word, but be able to teach and edit without too much criticism,
right?
Or with empathy.
Yeah.
Edit with empathy versus, you know, because people can take criticism many different ways.
Yeah.
Was that something that you all had to learn as you evolved, as you got bigger and brought in more designers? Of how to be able to quote unquote edit without, and then keep the creative juices flowing without stymieing people from being open with you about what they, their ideas are. How did that all evolve, or was it easy?
It wasn't and isn't easy. And I'll say I'm still a work in progress. I think if you were to ask some people, maybe I'm not very empathetic sometimes in terms of my critiques or criticism on a project. So it is, it's definitely an ongoing process. But I think that what makes it work is when we really do what we say we're going to do, when we really give people the opportunity to design. And so one of my favorite stories is we had won a project for University of Georgia. It was a new it was a project for their pharmacy school and at a satellite location in Augusta. And we were small at the time, and I was working directly on the project with one of our newer to the profession, emerging professional people in our office. And so we were working on the project together, and we were kind of going down a design path. And unbeknownst to me, she was at night working on an alternate design and something that she wanted, you know, that she thought would be a good solution for the project. And at some point she mentioned this to one of her coworkers, and they said, "You really need to show this to Gil, you know?" And she's like, "Oh, I don't know. I don't, you know," and they eventually convinced her to show this to me. So she did a presentation, and I said, "This is terrific." We threw everything else out on the spot and said, "This is what we're going to do." And it was just an amazing moment in time, right? Because her eyes get really big and she was so excited about that. And then all of a sudden this fear came over her face because she's like, "Oh my God, we're going to do this," you know? And I said, "Yeah, so we're going to work through, you know, there's some things we're going to have to work through, you know, from a technical perspective." But I think that when those moments happen, people understand, like, when we say best idea wins, we mean it, you know, like that was the best idea. That's what we're doing. And she was maybe at the time a year and a half out of school, and that project is built today, and it's her project. It's her design. That's what we did, you know? And so I think that that's part of what makes it work is when people see that we mean it, when we say that, you know, we want to say yes, we want it to be your design. We want the best idea to rise to the top, and that's what we're going to support. And that's what we're going to make happen.
Was the decision to go with her design an easy decision? I mean, from the standpoint of she's, I mean, it was a knock. She knocked it out of the park then.
Yeah, it was very easy. Yeah. I mean, and again, I think that's the part of this that makes it work is you have to be open to that. You have to be willing to say that is better and let's do that because I want what's best. I don't want my idea. I don't want, you know, to be just what I came up with. I want it to be the best idea. And that's what everybody in our company, you know, is kind of expected to buy into. So, and we see that in our clients too. I mean, we've got a client that, he is just absolutely brilliant, but he's very opinionated. He has very strong, you know, opinions about what he wants in a project. And he comes to meetings very prepared with a concept of, okay, this is what I think this should be. And, you know, we'll listen and then we'll present our solution. And if our solution's better on a dime, he'll turn, let's do that instead. you know, and like no ego, you know, he's super smart and his idea was really good, but maybe there was a part of ours that was a little bit better or, you know, or vice versa. And I think that you find that when everybody's kind of bought into that concept, you know, pretty amazing things can happen.
Do you find that the folks that you work with understand that concept, the best idea wins, meaning that they work harder? You see the product because the creative juices are, you know, in them. They want to show you a better product. Do you, I guess another way for me to ask that is, based on the concept, you getting a better work product out of your people.
I believe so. And I believe they understand that and buy into that. I hope they do. And all of our actions try to reinforce that. So like, for instance, we meet once a quarter, we meet with every position type in our office. So we meet with the emerging professionals and we meet with the project managers and we meet with the directors. And the whole focus on that meeting is, let's talk about best ideas. What are we doing that we should continue to doing? What are we doing that we should stop doing? You know, what are we not doing that we should be doing? You know, it's an open discussion about how do we get better as a company. And so I think that all of these little things go together to really create an environment where we're trying to encourage, you know, best idea wins. But that's a leadership responsibility, right? We have to get out of our own way. We have to make sure that the people in the room feel comfortable raising their hand with a better idea. And when they do have a better idea, we have to recognize it and then acknowledge it and then do it.
But was that easy to do in the beginning for you to get out of your own way and allow these folks to have the better idea?
I think it was. I mean, again, there may be people that disagree with that statement that might have been on the other end of it. But when I see, you know, something that's better, that's what I want. I feel like that was easy for me to do. You know, I think what's harder is when somebody has an idea that you don't think is better, how do you have a constructive conversation about that? And how do you make sure that it's not just preference, right? I want to do this because I like chocolate and you want to do that because you like vanilla. You know, you have to guard yourself against, it's just different. And this is what I want because I like this flavor. You know, one of the things I try to check myself and that, you know, you're basically not allowed to say in our company is, you know, because I said so, or because I'm a principal, or because I'm a project manager, or just do what I told you, you know, like that doesn't fly in our company. If I think this is the right path, I have to be able to articulate to you why I think it's the right path. And if I can't, then I need to check myself, right? Because that means maybe it's not the best idea, you know? So if you can't explain why it's the best idea and that goes from me, you know, to somebody just out of school, then, you know, you have to reassess whether it's the best idea.
So you said really something really interesting about your client and the no ego. Mm-hmm. Do you see that within your business as well? Is that something that you kind of actively kind of encourage? It's definitely something that we hear a lot more about in leadership styles more recently.
I'm not sure I know what you mean. You mean in terms of like promoting, not having an ego, that sort of thing?
As far as a lot of your decision-making process is around the best idea wins, right? So for that to happen, there really does need to be a lack of ego in lots of kind of levels of management. And I'm just wondering if that's something that you actively kind of promote.
It is something we promote. And I think there's a fine balance, right? Because ego can be a good thing, right? We want people to, you know, we want confident people around us. We want people that believe in what they're promoting and what they're putting on the table. We want people that are going to defend, you know, what they think is the best course of action. But we do talk a lot about, you know, is this the best idea? And to get there, you really have to check your ego at the door. And so we talk about that a lot as a company and how we make sure that, you know, we're promoting that. And, you know, having three other partners, you know, they keep me in check for sure. and don't let me off the hook if something's just, you know, I think that's, you know, they'll say, Gil, I think it's just something you want to do. Like, okay, you're right. You know, let's reassess.
From that perspective, as you've grown, have you figured out that there are things that you're obviously good at, but where I'm going is, what have you figured out you're just not good at and you need to delegate that to somebody else?
Yeah.
Because you'll end up, you know, screwing it up, destroying the company or whatever it is,
right.
you've evolved yourself and realized, I just can't do that. Is there something in particular that
– Is everything
– That can be, yeah.
I joke about everything, but there's a little part of that. I mean, we spend a lot of time talking about best and highest use and bringing people on that add something to the conversation. And so one of the dangers you have when you're an entrepreneurial person and you started a company and it was just you, you know, there were points in time in our company where I did everything, right? I mean, I was the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker. I, you know, took out the trash. I answered the phone. I, you know, had to do everything that the company needed to run as a company. And so there is a danger of, okay, I know how to do that. But at a certain point, you have to step back from that and say, okay, there are people that can do this much better than me. And really every aspect, there are people that can do that better than me and better than us. And so who are those people? How do we bring them on board? How do we get that value? So one of the things we did a couple of years ago is we hired an outside marketing company, Whitney Thrower. I'll give her a plug. But one of the things we challenged Whitney with when we first talked to her and when we engaged her was, look, we've had some success, so it's not like we're complete idiots about, you know, how to do this. We also kind of know certain things we should be doing that we're not doing, that we just haven't figured out how to be able to do those things. What we really are looking for from you is what do we not even know? What are we not thinking about that we should be thinking about? You know, because, you know, we know what we're doing that's been successful. We know what we ought to be doing that we're not doing, that we need to figure out how to do. But we understand there's a whole body of information out there that we just don't even know that we're not even thinking about, but we ought to be. And so I love bringing people like that onto our team that can help us think about things that we're not even, you know, they aren't even on our radar screen. And so I think that's something that we are constantly trying to do across every aspect of our company. And so I think there are people that, you know, we focus a lot on being subject matter experts and within the company, but also bring subject matter experts in externally.
And have you figured out from a strength and weakness standpoint, what is your greatest strength? Gills, not the company, but your greatest strength that you bring to the company.
Well, that's a tough one. You know, my role in the company, when everything is boiled down to it, is really to think strategically from a firm perspective. Where are we going? You know, and how are we going to get there? But it's also there's sort of three aspects. There's where are we going and how we're going to get there. It's what's happening right now that we need to make course corrections on, and then it's just to deal with tough problems, intractable situations. You know, there's so many problems that don't have a good solution. They're just problems, and it's not a matter of this is the right answer or that's the wrong answer. It's a matter of which direction do we need to go in, kind of thing. And so I think my greatest strength is the strategic thinking about the company. Where are we going and how are we going to get there? What should we be planning on for the next 3 to 5 years?
Hey, Neil, did you know that we have a sponsor?
I've heard the rumor, yes.
Do you know who it is?
No.
It's Flying Form Concrete Structures. Did you know, hang on a second. Did you know that they do turnkey concrete frames? Did you know that?
Can you explain to me what turnkey concrete frames
Now, we've been through this before. Our audience knows they're smart.
Well, yeah, but for those that don't know, can you tell us what turnkey concrete frame means?
Term means complete. They provide the complete package. Yeah,
that's exactly. Exciting.
I know, it's very exciting. And not only that, the quality of their work is incredible. And I have to say this because someone from Flying Form is sat very close to me and I want to make sure that I make him happy.
That is very important.
But it's also true. We're endorsing. Do we endorse? Is that how it work? No endorsements.
No, we don't endorse anything.
But they are paying, so we're saying nice things.
Yeah, we are saying that. They're just a sponsor, but we're not endorsing.
Okay,
we can't legally do that.
Can't legally. You're a lawyer, you would
know. Yes, no, that's right.
That's awesome. What we should do, I believe, is you should read out their website address so the wonderful people and listening to this podcast can go find them.
Yes, so the amazing Flying Form Concrete Structures They do incredible work. If you are interested in learning more about them, you can call their team at 770-971-7873 or visit their website at flyandform.com.
So how difficult was that for you? Obviously, the first part of My Architecture's kind of evolution was you doing everything and then transitioning kind of into this more strategic kind of planning and looking forwards rather than being in the nuts and bolts of the everyday. How difficult was that for you personally to transition between those two things?
Yeah, that was very difficult at first because trying to find the right balance between what level of involvement that I should have on every single project in our firm and not. And it's been a little bit of a pendulum, right? I think early on, I was still very involved in every project. And then there was this moment that we had in our company where we had a project that I knew nothing about. And at first, it really freaked me out. And then I was really excited about it. I was like, oh, my gosh, this project, our team went out and won it. They did it, you know, and I'm looking at the photographs. And this is, I mean, it was a small project, but it really, I was very excited about that. Because what I have told our leadership group from day one is I will feel like I've created a successful architecture firm when I am irrelevant. I want to be irrelevant, and because that means that I have we have the right people in the right positions doing the right things, and so it took a while to get there, and even today, I mean, sometimes the pendulum swings too far the other way, and you know, a problem is brought to my attention that they need some guidance on helping to solve, and I'm like, gosh, you know, I feel like I should have been more involved in this before it ever got to this point, kind of thing. And so, trying to find that right balance between it's an ongoing struggle. You know, it's something I learn every day a little bit more about.
But looking at the big picture, like you said, sort of your role, I'm just wondering, did you ever develop a business plan? Did you ever put anything in writing about what your goals were? I know you didn't at the beginning.
Yeah.
But was there ever a point in time you decided to just jot it down, or did you not do that? And it's okay if you didn't. I was wondering.
We have, I feel like at some point I may have developed some sort of business plan, but we do not operate from a business plan. What we do is we have retreats where we talk about goals. You know, we try to have an honest conversation about where we are. We have an honest conversation about where we want to get to and how are we going to get there. And so there's sort of this ongoing business planning concept that we are constantly doing, but in terms of like a formal business plan, in terms of, you know, this is our growth expectations and all this kind of stuff, that's just not how we operate.
And from besides typical economic struggles we all deal with, what are your daily struggles that you as a business owner contend with on a regular basis?
Yeah, well, Mark mentioned one, which is, you know, what level of involvement do I have, you know, with different aspects of the company?
I thought you was going to say GCs right there.
Yeah.
I did too. I was kind of hoping. I was like, darn.
GCs and lawyers, those are my biggest. Oh, wait.
Well, never mind.
And on that note.
Well, sorry. Great talking to you, Gil.
And that was the end of the podcast.
Yes. Well, we tried.
Struggles.
Yeah, struggles.
back to struggles. Believe it or not, actually, general contractors are not my biggest struggle. In fact, quite the contrary. We're fortunate to work with some great firms. And, you know, I think one of my biggest struggles is I feel like every project and every process, there's always a point at which there is a need for optimism and positivity, right? I mean, whether it's in the middle of a construction process and there's a tough situation and the contractor and our team are, you know, at odds with each other, or we're in the design phase and the owner is pushing for a solution that we just feel like is problematic. Either for their program or for their operations or whatever, and needing to kind of make sure that we are on a path where this is solvable and there's a solution that is workable for all parties involved. And how do we get there? And I think that just that need constantly arises. And I think that's something, you know, I struggle with, you know, every day. On a personal level, I struggle with all the normal stuff, you know, time management. And, am I working on what I should be working on? Am I doing what's my best and highest use? You know, because I'm just as susceptible as everybody else. Something piques my interest and I get involved in that part of that project or whatever. And sometimes at the expense of other things that I should be doing that are my best and highest use instead of that. So.
And then how do you, when you're dealing with these struggles, how do you de-stress? What works for you to just sort of check out, or what do you do so you can, you don't overwhelm yourself
sure.
with all the responsibilities that you have both in the office and at home?
Yeah. Well, recently I have gotten very serious about whiskey.
I'm liking where this is going. Tell us more.
So part of how I de-stress is, first of all, I love to spend time with my family. We travel a lot. We're outdoors a lot. And so that just immediately is a de-stressor, right? When you can spend time with your family doing fun stuff.
Like what? Give me an example.
Well, this weekend we were in Richmond, Virginia. My son fences. And so the fencing world is a lot of travel for tournaments because no one city has enough critical mass to really support, you know, a fencing league, so to speak. And so you travel all over the country for that. And so we were in Richmond, Virginia. Got to explore that town a little bit. We were there when they were having their Christmas parade and that sort of thing. So that's a lot of fun. Maybe more fun for me than my son. You know, he's in the competition and, you know, worried about that sort of thing. But we do that. We do a lot of hiking, paddle boarding, stuff like that. And so that's fun. But I'm an obsessive hobbyist. And so I'm into all kinds of different things. And
wait, are you making your own whiskey?
Not yet.
Ah,
not yet. That may come.
Is that legal? You're allowed to make your own whiskey?
I think as long as they don't sell it.
As long as you don't sell it, you can't distribute it.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking like crossing the border, you know,
he's not selling it.
Al Capone.
He's not selling it.
I'm just
checking. That was during Prohibition anyway. That's when everybody couldn't sell
it. Alcohol was always legal in England. We never did that. That was crazy.
Y'all never had Prohibition?
Nope.
It makes a lot of sense.
That explains so much.
Yes. So tell us about the whiskey.
Yeah. So I've had all these hobbies, and recently I kind of got into whiskey. And I was on a trip with some folks, and, you know, I've always drunk whiskey, you know, since I was in college, but I've never really thought much about it. And so one of the guys on our trip said, you know, let's do a blind tasting. And so tasting. So he went to the bar. We were staying at this lodge, and he went to the bar and he pulled out, you know, four or five bottles, and he poured us a little sampler of each one, but didn't tell us which one was which. And we went through and we tasted it. And it was kind of the first time I'd ever really focused on, you know, the nuances of different whiskeys. You know, my vocabulary up to that point was smooth or harsh. You know, I was like, oh, this is a smooth whiskey. This must be good. And so it just really sort of piqued an interest in me. And I just have this inability to just, I cannot scratch the surface on something. I have to go deep on whatever I'm interested in. So that was probably a year and a half ago. And so I've been building a whiskey collection. I have about 350 bottles now. I've got about...
In a year and a half.
Yeah, I know. It's a little sick.
Okay.
But I love it. And so, you know, I love it. There's this camaraderie part of it. I love having friends over, and we'll do just impromptu, like, hey, let's open this and let's try that. You know, just trying different things, comparing them to each other. But one of the things I love about the whiskey world, and this just fascinates me as a business owner, is, you know, we talk about our time horizon for, you know, the upcoming year, the upcoming 3 to 5 years. I mean, when you're drinking a whiskey that's 10 or 15 years old, I mean, just imagine that's somebody who made a business decision 15 years ago to do something that they weren't going to see any benefit from, you know, for another decade. And like, that just blows my mind. Right. And it really changes your perspective about what long-term decisions really mean and how to set your company up for the future. Because I mean, wow, that just blows. It really kind of blows my mind. I mean, you know, you're drinking a 10-year-old whiskey now. It's, you know, it was distilled in 2012, 2013, maybe, you know, 15-year-old was, you know, about the time they invented the iPhone. Wow. I mean, just think about that. I mean, that was a decision they made for something that we're drinking today. So I'm just fascinated by the whole process and how that relates to, you know, kind of our business decisions.
I'm going to ask this question, sure, but I probably shouldn't. Now, when you say whiskey, are you talking about whiskeys and bourbon or just whiskey?
Well, when I say whiskey, I'm using the general term because that includes bourbon and rye, scotch whiskey. Recently, I discovered a French whiskey. I didn't know the French made whiskeys. Japanese whiskey, Irish whiskey.
Japanese whiskey is pretty impressive.
It's really good. It's
really good.
Yeah, it is. It's really good. Yeah. So I'm using the general term. And a lot of times I'll say bourbon, but bourbon is a very specific type of whiskey that meets certain regulations. And so.
Right. Okay. Did you know that?
Yes, I did.
I'm just asking, just checking. Because some people don't like bourbon. They only drink different types
of whiskey. What kind of crazy people are
they? I don't know. I know, right? But there are people that prefer not to drink bourbon.
I know.
It's crazy. No friends of mine.
No. So you had mentioned earlier a book, and I was just wondering, is there a favorite business book or leadership book that you've read that you're like, man, people need to read this?
I don't read a lot of business books. I do listen to a fair number of podcasts, like your all's. Great podcast, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good plug. Fan of the show.
Thank you.
Checks in the mail.
Yep. Free pen for Gil.
I guess one book that did have a big impact on me was Good to Great. sounds like you've heard of it.
So many people that have sat where you're sitting have read and have talked about that book.
Is that right?
Yes.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that makes sense. There's some really powerful concepts in that book. And there's some concepts that I think, to me, fit in with this whole idea of best idea wins. You know, the author talks about brutal honesty. You know, you have to have the ability to look at your company and yourself with, you know, a brutal lens of like what not what I want to see, but what is happening? Where is our company? Where are we at this point in time? And what are our weaknesses and how do we need to get better? So that was one of the things I took away from that book. And then also they talk about this idea of getting the right people on the bus. And that's, again, something that I've always felt, you know, to be true. But until till we kind of made some misjudgments and some hiring mistakes, I didn't really fully appreciate how important that really was. And so we focus a lot more on that now.
It's a fantastic book.
It is a good book.
Tell us one person looking back that has motivated or inspired you. Mm. Other than
your mother-in-law.
Yeah. Other than your mother-in-law.
Well said. There've been several. Can I mention more than one?
Of course.
There's actually, I mean, sort of three come to mind as being very instrumental in my life and in you know where I am today as a business owner. The first, well, it may be a cliche, but it's my father. So the thing about my father is, first of all, as you read in that introduction that came from our website, my entire family is in education. So I'm the only person in my family that didn't go into education.
But aren't you in education in some respects?
I am, just in a different way.
Right.
But my father was a school superintendent. My mother was a middle school librarian. My oldest sister was a teacher, then a principal. And then my middle sister was a high school math teacher. And so my entire family worked in public education, except for me. But growing up, that was a big focus of ours, learning and figuring things out. You know, our dinner, we would have dinner together every night. And inevitably, there would always be some argument over some idea or something that was in the news that day or whatever. And there's a dictionary that was by our table. And, you know, at some point every night, the hand reached out for the dictionary to look up. It always hinged on the meaning of a word, right? And so my dad, it took me a couple of years to realize that when he opened the dictionary and read a definition, he was making it up to support his arguments. So I was like, all right, hang on a second. Let me see that. He was just such a resourceful person. So growing up, there was always a project that he had going on around the house. I mean, one time he built a barn, he restored old cars. At some point he became a private pilot, and then that wasn't enough. So he became an instrument rated pilot. Then he became a commercial rated pilot. Then he became an instructor. And then he decided, you know what? He became a certified mechanic, right? And so this is kind of the environment I grew up in, is this just sort of this resourcefulness and this thirst for hunger and knowledge. I mean, all of that was just on the side. That was his side gig. And so he was extremely instrumental to kind of my desire to want to be, to grow and to really dive deep into things and really figure things out. The first company I worked at, I worked with a man named Ray Moore. And what Ray taught me more than anybody else was that the contractor, looking at Mark, is not an adversary. You know, they're somebody that is a partner on a project, right? And if you want your design built, you know, you need to work in a collaborative way with the contractor. And he just had this way of working with contractors that was just very easy, very fluid. You know, we're all in this together. You know, we're going to make mistakes. You're going to make mistakes. Let's work together to solve them all. And we're all trying to accomplish the same thing here, which is a terrific building for our client. And then the last firm I worked at before I started my architecture, I had a mentor named Don Gletsis. And Don was so engrossed in this concept of the why. You know, why is something the way that it is? You know, we need to do this. Why do we need to do that? And that's really sort of the underpinning of the best idea wins, is it's the why part. Why is this done this way? Why, you know, you think that we ought to do this way, or the contractor thinks that this ought to be done that way. Why? You know, let's talk about the why, because once you understand the why, the answer is pretty self-evident at that point. And so these are just three people that have really kind of had these fundamental impacts on my life. And kind of, you know, it's at some level, I didn't think about it when I started the company, but gave me the confidence to, hey, I can do this. I can start a company and build a company I want to work in and, you know, create, you know, something unique on my own.
It's funny what you say about the dictionary by the table, because I have a 10, almost 11-year-old and 7-year-old, and we both, or the family, when we have these discussions, we actually have an Echo, Amazon Echo, right near the right near the dinner table in the kitchen. And so Echo gets asked questions a lot at dinner when we're looking at definitions.
I think that's great.
Time to move on.
Yeah, they will never forget that. I have never forgotten that. And just the quality of the conversations we had, I didn't appreciate it at the time, but I certainly did later.
Yeah, I was educating them on the difference between morale and morals, because they just thought I was speaking English and talking funny, which happens at my house.
Once in a while. We do the same thing, but usually it's like pop culture questions. You know, like how much is Taylor Swift worth? So we have to go ask the Echo.
Who cares?
I'm just saying.
It's a lot.
In our house, they care.
It's a lot.
I don't, but they care.
How much is she worth?
Over $1 billion now.
Man. Fair play to her.
Yeah, absolutely. Give us one nugget about yourself that people would be surprised by, other than the fact that you've 350 bottles in a year and a half.
And also, where do you live?
Yeah.
Come on over.
When's the party?
I share. Come over. I'll never drink all that myself.
Yeah.
I think that the people that know me from work and from the work environment, I think what they would be surprised about is, I mean, the whiskey is the latest obsession, but I just have a history of just these hobbies that I get into that it's the intensity at which I get into them, I think, is what people accuse me of. And so, you know, prior to that, I mean, since I've started the company, I became a private pilot. My dad was my instructor. I became a private pilot. I got into sailing for a while. I bought a boat. We had a lake house, and I bought a boat and sailed on the lake until my son was born. And it's really hard to sail with an infant on board. People do it, but that wasn't going to happen for us. I'm a beekeeper. This actually started, my wife got into it, and then I got into it. I'm like, oh, let's figure out how to maximize this. And so at one point we had 12 hives, and now we just have a couple. But I think what they'd be surprised about is just kind of the level of deep dive I get into of hobbies outside of the field practice of architecture.
Do you maintain any of the, I mean, obviously as a private pilot, you need to do a certain amount of hours per year, but what happens at the end of your, when you kind of like find your next new thing, what happens to the previous hobby?
Yeah. Yeah. You know,
cause they sound expensive, Gil. I'm not going to lie. They, flying, sailing.
Yeah. Well, you know, flying sounds so over the top, but like, you know, I had a 1979 Cessna 172, you know, the joke, as I was learning to fly, was that because it was such a small plane, it had such a small weight limit that I was going to have to lose as much weight as my son gained as he grew up, you know, for us to continue to fly as a family. So it was not anything glamorous or impressive. But yeah, I, they tend to fall by the wayside. The flying is a great example. Is you do have to not only legally stay current, but to really be a safe pilot, you need to fly frequently. And so at some point I stopped flying frequently and had enough sense to sell the plane. And and maybe one day I'll circle back around to that. And same thing with sailing. We sold the sailboat at some point in time after my son was born. And again, not an impressive sailboat, you know, kind of thing. I'll let you know when I'm tired of the whiskey thing.
Let me know.
I'll have a garage sale and you come over. Good thing about that is it keeps for a long time. So
it does keep.
What advice would you give your 18-year-old self?
I think what I would tell my 18-year-old self is to be more intentional. You know, I talked about when I started the company, you know, I didn't have this master business plan and game plan that I was trying to execute. That certainly worked out to my benefit because of the recession. I think looking back on it, you know, being more intentional about, okay, this is exactly what I'm trying to accomplish and this is how I'm going to get there. That's something that I've definitely brought into my life more in the last, you know, 15 to 17 years than, you know, I had before that. And so many things, you know, there are so many decisions that happen in your life that are presented to you and you take them. And that's important to be open to opportunity and to be ready to take opportunities when they arise. But there's also a component of being intentional. This is what I want to have happen. And how do I make it happen? You know, and that's sort of where we are as a company is that. And so I think I would tell my 18-year-old self, you know, be more intentional about what, you know, what you want to have.
And so you may not believe this, but the hour has flown past.
Oh, wow.
So one, thanks for coming on. But two, we have one last question that we ask all of our guests, and that is, who would you like to play you in a movie of your life?
So as a fan of the show, I anticipated this question. And my first thought was, who would ever make a movie about an architect? That is a losing proposition from a financial perspective.
What are you talking about? Click.
Fair point.
Click was a great movie. Adam Sandler,
yeah,
he was an architect.
I've seen that movie. Yeah.
Great movie.
Wasn't the guy in Three Men and a Baby an architect as well? Tom Selleck's character, maybe?
I think one of them was an architect.
Man, how about that of the memory banks?
That's a good memory.
And Steve Martin was an architect in that movie. It's complicated.
Well, there we go.
There's three. Okay, all right. So clearly movies about architects are high-grossing, you know, successes.
Yes.
Okay, so.
And I admit I watched that movie. It's complicated. It's a chick flick.
I love chick flicks, but I have not seen that movie. Okay. So I'll check that out. Anyway, so I asked my family and I asked some of my partners, you know, what do you think? You know, and I got a pretty broad range of answers. Everything very flattering from Harrison Ford to my son said Sean Connery. You know, I got Russell Crowe. Then I got some less flattering answers, like from one of my partners, like who plays Michael Scott in The Office? Like, you're talking about the actor Steve Carell, or you're talking about Michael Scott? Well, more Michael Scott, you know. I was like, oh no. But I think my answer to that is John Krasinski. And the reason why I like him is, you know, in The Office, he was kind of this, you know, out of shape, you know, doughy guy. But then he turned into this, like, you know, ripped special forces, you know, badass guy. And I still have that vision for myself that one day, you know, I could be that. So maybe John could, like, play this transformation of Gil May from, you know, 53-year-old, you know, overweight dude to ripped special forces guy.
You got to be intentional about your plan, Gil.
You know, that's a great point.
It can happen if you want it to.
I learned that from someone very recently.
Yes.
Really?
Well, Gil, we appreciate you coming on today.
It's been a pleasure.
I know you had no idea what to expect. I hope it wasn't as bad as you may have thought it would be.
It was great.
But we very much appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. It's been a pleasure.
Building Leaders Radio Hour is sponsored by Associated Builders and Contractors of Georgia. ABC of Georgia is a network of companies and professionals within the develop, build, design industry that is committed to connecting the disciplines of construction to benefit the industry, the economy, and employment in Georgia.